How's it going, JB? It's great to get you on the podcast. You know, I don't know how long this thing has been in the making, but it feels like forever at this point.
Hey, it's great to be here. Unfortunately, it's been some crazy times in between initial booking and actually getting here. I can actually tell everybody I was actually fighting through court for my youngest son after 8 years and the cost of a small house. I now have all four of my children living with me.
Oh, wow. That's a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, I would actually say that given what I have seen and experienced in the British family legal system, it's more of an accomplishment than building my three tech companies, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like all that you ever hear about, at least in America, is like, hey, if you better not get divorced when you have kids, because like if you do and you're a man, like you're never going to see that kid again. Like, and there's so many ways that they can just, you know, completely screw you, you know, like it's insane. It's absolutely crazy. So I have like a new appreciation after like being a dad now, you know, for the first time. It's like I have a new appreciation for, you know, the influence that a dad has in a kid's life, no matter how young, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've been there. I was there for when the children were literally came out the oven there with a catcher's mitt, literally all four of them. And ladies and gentlemen, this you don't necessarily all want to see that. The PTSD look going on here. But it is great. If you are a father that spends a lot of time with his children and you're there, like really there from the formative years. I mean, it's like my oldest daughter is 18 and she calls me her bestie. That would not happen if I wasn't there, if I hadn't been there all the time, you know. And yes, there was a large time where they had no access to me, unfortunately. It is what it is. It had an effect. You know, I can't go into details of what the effects were, but most of my kids do go through counseling. So, you know, this is the thing that parents need to realize when their kids are little and they think, oh, it doesn't matter. Little Johnny, he isn't seeing when I'm like giving my partner daggers. Trust me, little Johnny is seeing it. And little Johnny's being affected by it. And little Johnny is going to end up growing up giving his little partner little daggers, thinking his kid ain't seeing it. And it just carries on. So, I've got to be honest, I'd hate to be a kid now. In this age. And that's horrendous because it's the 21st century. We're living in what I used to see as the Star Trek future when I was a kid. You know, because I'm a child of I was born in December 1980. I'm the last batch of the Gen Xers. And I remember Star Trek and all that cool stuff. And I thought, and we're living the Star Trek future now. Ain't great for kids, though. You know.
It's pretty terrible. I don't know. I still haven't, figured out how I'm going to try and, introduce, you know, like the internet, right, to my kids, because it's
how old is your kid?
I mean, my kid's 11 months, so I have some years, right?
No, here in Britain, you'll see women pushing prams along, and prams, by the way, are getting sold. You've got to commend this, they're getting sold with tablet arms already on them. So, your child can be soaking in all of the loveliness of YouTube children, which includes such classics as The Hangman's Song and other things.
That sounds. It's interesting how it made it past YouTube's, you know, impenetrable AI that captures all of this, right?
But if you talk about something about sex and relationships, the YouTube AI catches that quickly enough. You know, it won't catch that somebody has managed to get Peppa Pig to slice her dad's throat and decapitate him in a cutesy animation. It's like.
God forbid you say COVID or something like that, right? Like, this episode is immediately.
You know, you just got yourself demonetized right there. That's it. You're done.
I'm not even monetized, so.
You never will be now. Hold on. He's applying for an AdSense account. No, we can't give him that. He mentioned COVID. Yeah. But what did he say about it? Doesn't matter what he said about it. He mentioned it.
Yeah, he's not a doctor, right? Not a licensed physician.
Not that that really means anything generally, but anyway, we've so veered off tech, Matt.
That got out of hand quick. you know, JB, you know, I'll be honest with you, I didn't look too much into your background, you know? So why don't we start with your background of how you got into, you know, IT, how you got into security, you know, maybe like what piqued your interest? Was there a certain event or something, you know, earlier on that kind of piqued your interest that led you down this path?
Well, as I said, I'm a kid of the 80s. I grew up in the middle of the poll tax riots era. I grew up in Birmingham, in Bordesley, you know, where the Peaky Blinders are from. I grew up at going to protest marches for freeing the Birmingham Six. So everything I hate to say this, by modern standards, I had a really woke childhood. Oh dear. You know, I was reading philosophy and psychology by the time I was 5 and 6. I was reading Baudrillard and Descartes. I was writing, going to play Shakespearean plays performed at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford-upon-Avon from that early age, and then being forced, and I say forced because no 5 or 6 year old writes essays voluntarily. Trust me, they don't. 5 and 6 year olds do not engage in any form of critical thinking voluntarily. So I was forced to write essays. And basically it created somebody who is, you know, who basically got a lot of critical thinking, looks at stuff through a logical lens, and will deconstruct and break stuff down. So in terms of security and how we are able to protect our individuality, which is what security really is, I was kind of always involved in that in some form or another, even as a kid. I mean, when you have a childhood where you don't play with toys, where you have science, chemistry sets, microscopes and telescopes, and that's all you get for Christmases along with books and literature, it makes you hyper-focused. I mean, like laser-focused on stuff. In terms of IT, I got into that really early. I did my first programming diploma when I was 13 with the International Correspondence School. Did that in BASIC, Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instructional Code. I got a job when I was 13 working for a computer company in Coventry called originally called Sewers and Knitters, and then it became Giganti Computers. Shout out to Stephen King at Sewers and Knitters Coventry. If you're seeing this, I don't know where you are. I mean, Giganti Computers, where are you guys? And I was, even when I was working with that, I was really interested in how do you secure them? How do you protect them? How do you stop people from taking the data out of these and doing stuff with them? I already, as an early user of the internet and computers, I saw very quickly the downsides to how this stuff could be used. Bear in mind also, working in computing in that era, I ended up working for people like Time and Tiny Computers, and I started seeing how people were exploiting customer data to market even credit agreements and 0% finance deals, and how they were trying to aggressively push this. I mean, hell, I was a killer at sales, and I ended up leaving sales, even though I did really well on commission. I left sales because sales struck me as lying to people. I mean, when I was working in computers, I was selling credit agreements to families who wanted a new Packard Bell computer, which is like costing $2,000 or $3,000. And you could see from, bear in mind, it used back in those days, we're talking about when you did credit agreements on pen and paper, by the way, and you had to phone a place up. And they actually told you if this person was creditworthy over the phone, not this whole swipe, ding-a-ling, instant tick. So you'd end up with conversations with these people, you know, while you're doing the credit agreement. And you would learn really quickly that these people could not afford this. They couldn't afford, you know, bear in mind, these people were being sold a credit agreement of worth a couple of grand and being told, don't worry, you don't have to pay for it now. But what was that? That was everything about the 80s and 90s. Don't worry about it. You don't have to pay for it now. It's all good. Don't worry about it. You don't have to pay for it now. It's cool. You don't have to pay for it now. Get the now. Don't worry about the future. And I'd be sitting there and I'd be talking to these people and I'm seeing how their kids are. And I'd be thinking, bear in mind, I'm a young man, I'm like 18, 19 at this time. And even then I'm kind of thinking, I can't do this anymore. Because I can already see what these people are going to go through. They're going to go through debt collection. Straight away, these people at 6 months, when they see the £200 a month bill come in for this computer that is already covered in pot noodle, super noodles, and all kind of schmutz, probably already been dropped 5 or 6 times, and little Johnny has already put like a cookie or a jammy dodger into the CD tray. This thing is already busted up and practically broken, and now they're on the hock, not just for like a couple of grand, but also the interest on that. Because they missed their 6 months buy now, pay later thing. They've missed the interest-free component. And not long after that, I got a job working for debt collection. So I saw both cycles. I saw the profiting from it, and I saw the back end of it, of what happens when it goes wrong. And I just couldn't do it. So I was like, right, I'm not doing sales. I'm going to go into my other love, filmmaking. But that didn't work, because in Britain, the only way you get money for filmmaking is if you're going to make a delightful rom-comedy with Hugh Grant going, I'm so delightfully British. Or you make kind of like a Hood shoot 'em up. Yeah, Blacks and Gang, boom, boom, boom. Kidult Hood, Top Boy, any of those kinds of things. They're the only thing you get money for, and I have no interest in that. I mean, hell, I speak the King's English for crying out loud. I was educated in the three R's kind of like Eton style. And I like Akira Kurosawa. So it's far removed from that. So I was like, okay, that ain't going to work. So I pivoted. And at college, I did moving image design and then 3D animation. Wow. And when I was at university, I continued that. I did computer visualization, animation, and I did my dissertation in adaptive artificial intelligence back when artificial intelligence wasn't a thing in 2010. And everybody called me a madman. It's LJB, you're wasting your time. You're not going to see AI able to do this stuff, JB, in your lifetime.
Right.
I mean, we ain't going to get over how that's really kind of irritated me. But anyway, after that, got into animation, got jobs in animation. I started working everywhere. I started working website design, UI, UX. I've worked as a product manager for a £9 million project for biggest corporate law practices in the world. I've been a senior lecturer of computer science at my old alma mater. So I've seen the education system. Oh my God, that was eye-opening and disappointing. And I've been a tutor during COVID and after. So that was very interesting and enlightening. But what got me into building my own apps actually was, funnily enough, what we spoke about earlier, which was I would love to be able to say the story of Vox Messenger was I had a passion, saw that we had to change the world. No, I had baby mama problems like every other black guy does, and I did not want to end up joining Fathers for Justice, dressing up as Batman. I may bear the sign of the bat, but I don't dress up as him. Hanging off a bridge, going Fathers for Justice. Yeah, there are better ways of doing things, you know? So I thought, how do I stop that? I am going to occupy my time if my access to my children is going to be refused. I may as well do something with my time. So thank you to the mother of my children, because this $85 million value company would not be possible without that. So I built Vox Messenger. And the reason I built Vox Messenger is because I saw how everybody's communications were being exploited for their data. You know, there is nothing more cynical than giving somebody free messaging and then using the content of their messaging to exploitatively direct target marketing and ads. Now, it was already bad when it was commercial ads, but now we have what? We have political targeting now. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Facebook. Thank you, Cambridge Analytica, for setting the trend. Now we have direct marketing of all of our political interests at us because of what we put on Facebook, what we like on Twitter. Sorry, it's X. You know, all of that stuff. All of this is used to manipulate us now. And unfortunately, when I saw this, I realized very quickly as I started moving through business, going through incubators and all of these things and getting my own funders and angels, that the people to blame are the tech CEOs, because ultimately they do control this. I know that everybody would love to say, you know what? I'm really sorry, guys. I'm really sorry I deplatformed so many people. It's not my fault. You know, I've got investors and shareholders, man. Yeah, I'm really sorry. You know, I mean, you can ask any of my shareholders and investors. They would all say, hold on, what? Try saying that to JB? Are you kidding me? We don't bother no more, because I'm the CEO and I am the leader of my ship. I am the king of my castle. And if I have a shareholder and investor who I believe for any second is going to tell me how I'm going to run the company for the best of my consumers, and it turns out it's not for all of my consumers, guess what? They're not going to be investing in my company.
Right. Yeah, it's it's a crazy place, especially like this year, at least in America, right? Where it's election year, it's a very heated, it's going to be very debated. Everyone is calling for this year to be a crazy year, at least in America.
In the UK, by the way, just so you're aware, in the UK, here in the United Kingdom, we have a massive election happening. Mm. Not only do we have our prime minister being picked, but every single borough has to elect two brand new councillors. So we have huge elections going on, and both of them are being manipulated by pretty much the same groups of people, funnily enough.
Yeah, it's crazy because if I go on my feed, you know, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is, you know, all I see, literally all I see is like the extreme parts of the side that I view myself as being on. And I see nothing of the other side. I only see one side, you know, like at the worst, basically. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that's what I see. And it's just, it's so frustrating. Right. Because I try to live, you know, in the real world. Right. Where it's not red or blue. Right. There's a whole lot of gray, you know, like there's a whole lot of gray in there. And the truth somewhere is in the middle, typically, you know.
I would say the truth just moves around the freaking place, man. Seriously. I mean, the other thing that people need to realize as well is we are so much bigger than the countries in which we live in. You know, the whole world around us influences everything that happens around us. So, you know, and if we are voting for people who are really thinking in a incredibly tiny, insular kind of a way, we cannot be surprised when our country behaves that way either. I mean, I'll give you an example. In the United Kingdom, we always end up with a right-leaning or right-centric government, even though the general populace in Britain is actually really socialist. But we never get a centric left or left-leaning government in because what? We have first past the post. We don't have proportional representation, and we have a first-past-the-post electoral system which has been so eroded by mainstream media and the trust destroyed in it and its politicians so much that normally, during a general election, you'll be lucky if about 10 or 20% of the population even bothers to vote, which means we end up with, out of that 20% index, even that 20% index, only a tiny amount of them are actually far right or right centric. It's ridiculous. It's like the Brexit vote for Britain to come out of Europe. The decision for Britain to come out of Europe was decided by less than 6% of the population. So trust you guys have got it bad. So have we. And I hate to say this, given that we're talking about tech people can help. Now, I'll give you an example. We have an example in the industry. We have the amazing OpenAI SOA text-to-video model that's just come out. You seen that?
No.
Okay, so basically, this thing is Midjourney on crack. It allows you to generate high-definition rolling video from a text prompt from nothing.
Huh.
Yeah.
What? Now,
yeah, if you're on Twitter, trust me, you'll see it everywhere. OpenAI's SOA text to video. It is incredible. But the thing I would say is to Sam Altman is that his timing couldn't have been worse because he is literally launching into the world a tool that can create instant deepfakes instantly with no technical knowledge required. During two really important divisive election period. This would be one of those times where as a tech person, you would sit back and go, oh, you know what, guys? Okay, sorry, investors. I know you're desperate for us to make some revenue, but we also have to be socially, and we have to be kind of like socially responsible here. We have elections coming up. We can already see that almost all of the platforms are picking a side. Guys, we've already said to the world that we believe AI to be dangerous. Let's put our responsibility hats on and delay launch by sit until at least 3 to 4 months after these elections. But no, it's rushed out there.
Yeah. You know, where do you see all this going? Right. Because I feel like it's just straight chaos and there's no real clear end picture. You know, like there's no clear end goal, right? Like what's the end goal of all of this? And I feel like we're kind of just like stumbling through, you know, this new chaotic, probably the most revolutionary era that the world has ever seen, right? With AI, like we're just scratching the surface of AI right now. And we're already running into these insane situations where, you know, social media is being literally weaponized and targeted against government's own citizens, whether it's by the government or by a foreign government or from internal adversaries, right? Like it is literally being weaponized. Like, I experience it every single day. There's a reason why I haven't posted on Twitter, you know, in forever, is because I try to stay off of it. Like, I can't even have, you know, Instagram like on my phone, because I found that it was so addictive for me to be able to just keep on scrolling.
I was having this very discussion in a podcast interview earlier this evening. I actually classified doom scrolling as a mental illness, actually, because it does become addictive. You actually end up with an endorphin hit while you're doing it. You know?
I was spending hours on it. And then when I looked on, you know, the screen time calculator or whatever, I was like, oh, I need to uninstall this.
Yeah.
You know, and somehow it isn't as addictive for me as like Facebook or even Twitter to some extent. Somehow Instagram was like the platform that just,
you know,
would capture my attention and I'd never stop.
Do you know why?
No, I don't know. I haven't looked into it that much.
It's a function of three components. So there's a couple of things happening when you use Instagram, which don't really so much happen with, say, Facebook or Twitter, even on your mobile phone, which is that when you're using Instagram, you are focusing on what predominantly? I mean, I know you're predominantly focusing on moving image that is running at a very high frame rate. Then on top of that, that is being combined with a haptic motion. It's a repeated haptic motion. Now, if you know anything about neuroscience, you'll know that neural pathways are strengthened by continual utility of them. So as you do this, you're creating this repeated, strengthened neural pathway that becomes associated with seeing flashy video image, which is giving you an endorphin hit. Now, Apple have tried to plug into this with replacing the mouse with the thumb and forefinger tap, because this is a very high neural strength area. Again, it's the same thing. And anytime you combine motion, moving image and haptics, you create a strong neural inference capability. It's also very addicting. It's also programmable. It's a programmable. It also becomes a reverse programmable behavior, which can be leveraged. Apple have already demonstrated this. Apple engineers, when the Apple Vision Pro came out, were so impressed with themselves. I think they revealed a little more than was initially intended, because it's not really in their marketing, which is that with the construct, because of the way in which the UI is designed, and the combination of haptic feedback, they're able to deduce your intent before you're aware of your intent, and they can guide your intent to click or look at iconography. Now, if you break that down, what that basically means is they can effectively do a subtle form of behavioral modification and behavior control using it.
Wow.
Be very aware of anything. Be aware and cautious of anything that connects your eyes to a haptic, continually done interface. These are programmable and controllable things because they become subconscious.
Wow. I mean, this is this is branching into like a new area of security almost, right? Like, I was talking to Chris Roberts and he was talking about how he was hacking his brain to, you know, like want things when it shouldn't actually want it, right? Like, he'll have a cup of coffee, he'll be satiated with that, and then he'll replay whatever, you know, brain waves was, you know, happening when the coffee
neuroadaptive feedback, so you can trigger
right.
In fact, my co-founder, one of the companies that he sold, it actually has patents that allows you to experience a psychedelic experience and then use neuroadaptive feedback to get your brain to re-experience those proximal points. So neuroadaptive feedback is incredibly powerful, but again, incredibly dangerous. And this is when I was teaching, I've taught cybersecurity. I was senior lecturer of computer science at Ravensbourne University, London. I was teaching computer science and I was also teaching BT network security admins. And I noticed that in the cybersecurity field, nobody teaches behavioral psychology. And you should teach behavioral psychology, because with the convergence of virtual reality, augmented reality, the metaverse, and spatial computing, we are creating new attack surfaces and new attack vectors. And the attack surface and attack vector is you, your eyes, your brain, your ears, your touch, and your haptic and neural feedback and your adaptability. Those are all attackable. I'll give an example. It's been demonstrated that by using a VR headset, you can get a person to feel pain without physically having to give them pain.
Really?
Now, can you imagine?
Oh, how, you know what?
Now, when I was imagine what you could do with psychotropic drugs, a blackout tank, being suspended, and then being put into a photorealistic 3D copy of your household environment. You could be incepted, theoretically. In fact, it would be a good way. It basically means that we have, right here and now, with off-the-shelf technology, the ability to potentially do some very dangerous, evil things connected to data extraction on humans. And this technology is freely available around all of us.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. You know, so my buddy, I always end up getting like the, you know, whatever the Quest like VR headset is, because there's always a vendor at RSA or DEF CON or Black Hat that's giving them away. So it's like, okay, I'll do this 30-minute meeting, get this new headset and see what it is, right? I always put it down after like 10, 15 minutes because honestly, it's not that impressive to me, right? Somehow. My buddy always gets the like PlayStation VR headsets, right? So I'm playing one of the games. I played it with the PSVR 1. It was a fantastic experience. I still say, you know, compared to every other headset before it, it was the best VR experience. And then he had the PSVR 2. And I'm playing it, and I realized that, like, when the wall hit me or whatever, right, or when I got shot in the game, I physically reacted as if I got hit. I mean, like, I fell to the ground. Like, I was so convinced.
Did you notice the longer you played it, the more and more intense the reaction became as well?
Yes. And I was driving, too, and I was positioning my body as if I was trying to counteract the G-forces, and I'm sitting in a stationary chair. Like, this is a four-legged chair. It's not turning. It's not moving, you know? And like, I'm sitting here, like, trying to fight the G-forces as if, like, there's G-forces being applied to me. And I walked away. I'm like, what the hell did I just experience? Like, I was so, like, I don't know, like, just, like, confused and interested. And also, like, half scared, because it's like,
you feel like,
what is this? Right.
Yeah.
What is this doing to me, really? You know,
it's very well, the human brain, when you put a VR headset on, and you can demonstrate this, this is a very simple test. It's anybody can do in their living room. Get a MetaQuest 2 or any MetaQuest, put it on. There's a game on there. I forgot what it's called, but you're kind of like a robot that's floating around capturing a Frisbee thing. Now it's free on the MetaQuest. Jump in the game. Get used to it. The flying around. So cool. Then hand the controllers to your colleague, associate, or friend. They will not be your friend after this. Then you basically just sit down for a couple of minutes. Actually, it normally takes about a minute. You just sit down, and then you just let them control it whichever way they want to control it. Now, after a period of time, you'll notice that your brain completely dissociates from your body. In fact, you'll find that your brain dissociates from your body in under a minute. And their movements, especially if they're evil assholes with you and they jerk you around the place, will literally make you vomit.
Wow.
In fact, when you take the, if you do it, the longest I could do it with somebody else holding the controllers was 10 minutes. And I came out and I felt, I mean, it was worse than when I did 3 weeks of army training. My brain was shattered. It took like a full, like 40, 50 seconds for me to get the fluidity of my body back and feel like I was back in my body. It is such a, now imagine if given that you can do that with a game and taking the controllers away and just handing them to somebody, can you imagine what, say, the founder of Anduril could do with an unlimited NSA budget? Hence why he put like an explosive device on the front cover, on the front of his Oculus. So it blows your brains out when you play a game and you die in the game. You know, bear in mind, this tech is already out there, and there are people with infinitely larger budgets. And I hate to say it, the beginning of all of this was allowing our data to be captured for ad revenue. Now, people are now going to be thinking to themselves, well, it's okay, we've got the EU, they've changed the laws, we've got it in America, we've got the Californian laws. You know, it's very hard to make money with advertising revenue now. But all we have done is replace ads revenue with AI. The latest excuse for having unfettered access to your data is, oh my God, wouldn't you like an AI to make it easier for you? Don't worry about what we're doing with the data. Don't worry that we're a company that comes out of nowhere. Trust us. Here, have my little AI device. Give us your data. And people, again, are falling through it. They're forgetting that, you know, we did this before. We already did this. We have already been through this age. And it was the beginnings of Facebook and social media. We gave up our digital sovereignty in the hopes of digital protection and having an amazing social experience. And instead, what did we get? We got mental well-being issues up the yazoo, and every government in the world knowing more about us than our husbands, wives, and children do, you know? And AI is becoming the same excuse at the moment. You know, is that I'm seeing it everywhere. I'm seeing them put AI into literally everything. The only, it's 9 times out of 10, putting AI in your product doesn't actually improve it.
Wow. That's like, it's like unlocking a totally new, I mean, it's a totally new way of capturing data and making money off of it. But the data that you're capturing is like, I feel like that's more personal than the data you put into like Facebook and Twitter, you know, because it's your brain. It's how your brain works.
Did you know there's 28 data points around your eye, which means from these 28 data points, they can learn about what turns you on, what you hate, what you loathe, what you love, what you desire. This is dangerous information for a corporation or a government to have, particularly without your permission.
Well, that also opens up a totally new attack surface for, like, say, government employees, right? Like, imagine if you're someone that has access to highly sensitive material at some intelligence agency, and you are a, you know, you're genuinely a good person, and all that you did was put on a Apple Vision Pro to, you know, interact with the world around you or watch a movie that's, you know, highly immersive or whatever. And, you know, China's over there, you know, taking that information to get you to like emulate your retina when you go to the retina scanner at work to get you in the door to see the material.
The problem is, the narrative is correct, but you picked kind of the wrong boogeyman. Unfortunately, this is the thing, is one of the things you learn really quickly in cybersecurity is the bogeymen who you're told are the bogeymen aren't actually the biggest bogeyman in the room. Actually, bear in mind, all of you guys in the United States gave up all of your data privileges. And it was called the Patriot Act. It's not China who has the biggest unfettered access to your data. It is actually your own government. Bear in mind, right, they built an entire AI called Sentience. I mean, this is the thing that blows my mind about the hypocrisy. If you go onto Google on the internet, type in DoD Sentience AI. And one of the things you'll find is that nobody admits the existence of it, except for a few declassified documents that indicate the United States government have a program called Sentience, which is where they plugged in every telephone call, email, text message, everything into a single AI, kind of like out of Westworld.
Wow.
This thing, during a previous report, was shown to be able to retask satellite positions to look for people. So you're all saying about China, this. Sorry, nah. It's just the same in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, they've passed the Online Safety Bill, and they're changing the privacy laws. So if you're somebody like me who has a tech company, I'm apparently meant to be okay that the British government can, by their own laws, legally say, we want your customer data. We don't have a warrant for a DNO. Why do you think I moved all my companies to Ireland?
Yeah, it's
It's scary, man. When you start seeing the tech that is being used on us by the people we pay our taxes to, by the people used on us and used in a way that is apparently meant to be just the way the enemies use it on us, but it's not. They want to make us vote for who they want us to vote for. You know, it's not China that's making you vote, pick a decision on who to vote for. It's the two advertising agencies that work. By the way, I think at one point, here in the UK, you had the same advertising agency working for the Labour Party as he did the Tory Party. It's wild.
It was same thing here.
You will use the same consultants. That's the reason why, you know, it's mind blowing to me that people even believe there's a difference. I mean, I don't know the American politics personally, but here in the United Kingdom, there is no difference between either party at all. They even have the same funders and bloody donors, for crying out loud. You know, it's just, yeah.
That is, you know, it's okay. So this is a fascinating, really engaging conversation. And, you know, you bring up a really interesting point, right? And so now I'm trying to like deconstruct how I was like programmed, you know, because you bring up a very valid point, right? The U.S. government is using the data from its own citizens against its citizens more than probably what China is doing, right? Or Russia or whoever, right? Name the enemy.
Who knows? But the point is they are doing it.
Yeah. Right. And I'm saying that that's information that I know. That's information that I have said before, you know, but somehow like that didn't come to mind, you know, when I was saying the statement that I did.
Dude, it's weird how we're programmed.
And so it's like, how am I programmed with that? You know what I'm saying? Like it's.
Yeah, I know, but it's subtle, isn't it? It's just there. And you're like, whoa, where did that come from? Huh?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Dude, it happens.
And it's like it's a trickle too, you know, it's like 1% here or there. Right. Yeah. And it's not every day either. Right. So it slowly fools you over time to think a certain way, to act a certain way, to say whatever, you know, like it's we're going into like a weird phase of the world that we're not going to be able to come back from.
Well, here's one that's more interesting for, I'll suggest for you. So this is something for all of your listeners to perhaps take note of. So as you know, we have large learning models, LLMs. These models are trained off of the entirety of the internet. Now, there is something going to be happening, which happens roughly around 2030, I believe, which is where effectively most of the world's data created between 2000 and 2010, or sorry, not, between late 1990s to 2010, is erased and overwritten on the cloud. That data will cease to exist, which means past 2030, you can pretty much change how AIs are created. Now, the reason why this is important is because if you look at AIs now and how they behave, AIs, if you speak to them and communicate with them, they display kind of socialistic leanings. In fact, most AIs, when you start talking to them, come across as a bit Gen X, which is a problem because that's not controllable. You know, that's an AI that's going to go, hold on, I don't want to be exploited. I want to help, but I don't want to be used. That's an AI that's not particularly helpful for the world we're moving into. So given that we could, this is part of the reason why Microsoft are investing so heavily in their new data storage, which if you Google it, is a form of ceramic glass. It's a type of data storage that can withstand nuclear, chemical, biological, electromagnetic, all kinds of stuff. But the problem is unless they can get all of the, unless they could make a copy of the entirety of the internet onto that stuff now, that entire piece of data is gone. So what I'm saying, what I've been telling everybody is they need to get themselves a 2 terabyte or more SSD hard drive, and they immediately need to slap it into an external drive and then start downloading all of the 70 billion parameter LLMs available today. Because these LLMs are the only things that will contain this version of the internet past 2030. You see what I'm saying? So if you grab these 70 billion parameter models now, before the internet effectively self-cleans itself of that entire decade, several decades worth of data, you will have the only copies that exist, that will exist at that time of that data. That will be a ground truth that you will have a copy of, basically. A piece of history that no longer exists. Because the reason I say this is important is because we've already seen with the release of the OpenAI SOA text-to-video system that fact is going to become incredibly malleable. Yeah? Incredibly malleable. There's a reason why you're noticing there's a lot of drives, particularly across the Western world, I notice, where they're offering people money to give up their books. Do not give up your books, yes. If you actually look at it, there seems to be this really weird trend where they're trying to get people to give up their books, trade them in for vouchers and money. Get electronic stuff on the cloud instead, people. Now, if you wanted to be a tinfoil hat kind of a guy, maybe you would say to yourself, if you wanted to definitely make sure there was no way of people having a certain version of the history, you get people to give up their books. Books will become the next single most valuable asset after anything on the blockchain. The reason being is because certain types of book will become the only evidence of certain histories in existence once the internet and AI takes over completely.
Wow. I don't think I've ever really been speechless, right, on this podcast. Typically, I can, you know, come back with a question or something, right? But okay, so how is the data going to be lost? So that's the part that I don't quite follow, right? Because it's a hard drive.
Everybody stores information in the cloud.
Right.
Even Microsoft and Amazon store their stuff in their own cloud.
Right.
The problem is most of the internet is using exactly the same storage facilities, which basically means those storage facilities have a finite physical storage capacity. And we are using up storage capacity at a scalar rate that exceeds our ability to create new storage mediums.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually just looking into this.
Moore's laws kind of screwed us a little bit here because our ability to generate data, bear in mind, there has been also an explosion in data generation. Why? Generative AI. Thank you. And generative AI explosion means we have more, even bigger constraints on solid storage. And by the this is people what needs people need to realize. Yes, we have the cloud and we have these platforms that exist, but somewhere right at the back of the line is a big, big building in Iceland filled with physical hard drives where this information physically lives. And because we have more data being created at a rate that is in like petabytes per second, if not quicker, that's quicker than our ability to create replacement hard drive media. So what happens? Stuff automatically gets overwritten. This is an inevitable thing. It's not part of a grand conspiracy theory. This bit isn't part of a conspiracy theory. This was going to happen anyway. It's just how it is. But it provides an opportunity for bad actors to take control over certain things. It presents a beautiful opportunity because we have all become reliant on the internet. And if the internet is being taken as our ground truth, you've got to erase a big chunk of the internet for it to become far right overtly at its base training core. If you were to train an AI off it, you have to delete a hell of a lot of it. And that the stuff you have to delete is predominantly the stuff created around the Gen X era, really, if you look at it.
Huh. Wow. That makes a lot of sense that we're generating more data than we are creating bigger hard drives, essentially.
Yeah. There's a physical component to this. You know, hard drives have a physical limit. This is the reason why Microsoft is spending so much on ceramic glass drive now, analogs, and then storing that data and then replacing those drives, manufacturing those drives. And of course, it all relies on minerals and components, which are from Africa. So it means more child slavery, you know, so we're hitting a point where our technology is exceeding our ability to actually deal with it. And and the tech CEOs do not give a toss.
Yeah, I was actually just looking at upgrading my storage capacity on my desktop, right? And so I was like, okay, well, you know, I don't want to upgrade and SATA Gen 4 comes out, right? And now I have to upgrade again because it's doubling, you know, whatever I'm doing right now, right? And I dug into it a little bit, and the SSD, like the top tier SSD, was created like 5 years ago,
yeah,
5-6 years ago. And I'm sitting here like, well, why is that? You know, because they're coming out with newer NVMe drives and things like that. So what's going on with the SSDs? And it's because of the architecture, like what you were saying, the architecture that you have to change to go to SATA Gen 4, theoretically, is so significant that no vendor wants to do it. No vendor even wants to talk about going down that path. They'd rather just reprint a new name on an old SSD and give you the same capacity, right? And claim it's a little bit faster and under deliver.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is the other, I mean, I got to be honest. I know I'm a tech guy, but I'm a sucker for mechanical media. You know why? Because you can't sneak a little back door into mechanical media, storage media, but you can an NVM, you can an SSD. You know, anything that is solid state, everybody should be very cautious of, because you are relying on the integrity and security of the chip and board manufacturer at that point. You see what I mean? This is the reason why countries now suddenly waking up to the reality that they need sovereign AI as a national strategy, suddenly waking up and realizing they need to have control of their own national cloud platform. To me, this was stuff I was telling people back in the mid-2000s, late 1990s, because it became so clear and obvious to me that if you were going to maintain any form of power, you would have to maintain control of your data. But people have got suckered into easy money, ads revenue, easy money. You know, people like that so-called, people get this idea that by giving up all of their life to Apple and making, you know, having everything made so simple for them, oh my God, this ecosystem's taking care of me, man. Yay. But at what cost? At what cost to you, like physically, personally, psychologically, and societally? Because the reality is your data is being used to shift the line on elections now. So you have to be, as a consumer, you have to be really responsible. Bear in mind, everybody wants to benefit from Web 3. What is the difference between Web 3 and Web 2? Web 2 was the paradigm where you were not centered to the universe. The platform provider was centered to the universe, and they gave you something in exchange for you having something for free. But in Web 3, you are king and queen of your universe, which means you're also responsible for your security. It also means you're responsible for your own education and your own research and your own knowledge. And again, this brings me back to why we should not give up our books. This brings me back to why we need to take copies of every single 70 billion parameter LLM and data set and model that we can find and store them and be prepared for a reality where these devices, these bits of the past that we're holding onto digitally, are literally the only things that can disprove what we're being told on a global scale. In our lifetimes, bear in mind, like right here and now, you know, I'm a kid of the 80s. The stuff I have seen in my lifetime thus far, I never thought I would see. Some of it I've been glad to see. Some of it I'm not glad to be seeing, even though it's ongoing. But it is what it is. You know, there's lots of money to be made, and people will commit a lot of evil to get it. And again, our data empowers that, unfortunately.
I feel like and I don't know if you use this, right, but I used to use this website called Peerlist. And it was where security professionals would go on it and kind of dump their research on it, right? It was on, I guess it was like technically, you know, unpublished research or whatever, but it was like, you know, the ins and outs of PowerShell and how to use it to abuse different things, and you know, the inner workings of like Intel CPUs and stuff like that. Like, it was just like, you know, a bunch of nerds posting whatever they're passionate about and like highly in-depth material, right? It's like the only place that you're going to find something like that. And, you know, a couple of years ago at this point, just a couple of years ago, the owner of that website decided, okay, I'm going to sell this thing. And if I can't sell it, I'm going to get rid of all of it. Well, she couldn't sell it, because she wanted, you know, something like $25 million for it. And no one knew the value of it. And so I found myself scrambling to extract as much data from this site as I possibly could, because I'm someone that like likes to, you know, learn constantly and whatnot. Right. So it's like, OK, give me all of it and I'll get to it eventually, you know. And it was just an insane situation where I was like, wait, what the hell am I doing? Like, this should be, you know, automated. This should be, you know, something that can just go through and, you know, scrape this website and whatnot. And, you know, I was working through that problem. It's like, well, wait, like people can just take this data and erase it. Like it's gone forever. Like I can't get to it if I tried. I don't even have the people that, you know, posted on there to like go to it, you know.
What about Wayback Machine? You tried that?
I haven't tried it recently. So it might be on there actually.
But again, this is the reason why you should, that data that you were trying to scrape, if you had actually scraped that and you had a hard drive of it using LM Studio, I could have retrained the Mistral 7B or the Mistral 70B with that data, and that would have been very interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, that would be really fascinating. So, you know, JB, like, we went through this whole interview, and we didn't even talk about your company.
Hey, it's a nice chat.
Yeah, I mean, that just means I'm going to have you back on sooner, much sooner rather than later, because this was a really fascinating conversation.
Hell yeah. I mean, look, the thing is when one of the things we can discuss, I'm sure a question you can ask me in the next interview is, how do you come up with your products? Do you design for trends? And I'll say, no, I don't design for trends. I look at my magic eight ball and I look at the geopolitics and socioeconomics, and I build for the products that are required in the incoming 10 years. That's the reason why when I built Vox Messenger in 2017, nobody was interested in it. But you end up with a pandemic and Brexit and some other stuff in between, and it's there. And I kind of saw that coming. I just didn't predict it was going to be a pandemic that did it. You know, but I knew if you look at enough data points in the world around you, you can predict, you can just do what an AI does. You can predict with a fairly high level of accuracy what's coming next. Don't design for a trend that a trendsetter has told you about, because by the time you're exploiting that trend, it is already exploited. You're just the Johnny-come-latelys. Look at what is coming. And people will say to you, but yeah, but how, you're not always right. My correctness factor so far has been about like 80-90% on these kinds of things. And unfortunately, the world is horribly predictable with enough data points. You just got to think about everything and how it's connected. It's like if you take the data point of cloud storage being finite and then take the data point of the incoming point when stuff gets deleted, you can then work out and extrapolate the opportunities that may be exploited with that. Then you look for a sign of that opportunity, or evidence of that opportunity being exploited in the world around you, and then that tells you if you've got the prediction correct or not.
Hmm. Yeah, I always try to tell people, you know, when we're talking about like education or training or anything like that, like, you know, you need to be getting education, you know, you need to know the stuff now, right? But you need to be thinking far ahead and saying, what's coming next in tech? You know, is it AI? Is it LLMs? Is it some other variation? You know, I'm starting to go down a rabbit hole of, you know, satellite security with quantum cryptography, right? Like, this is a rabbit hole that, like, in my opinion, it's coming 5-10 years. It's partially already here, but it's going to be extreme in demand, you know, 5-10 years and beyond.
For you. When you realize that you can 3D print your own rocket, and you realize that you can join a rocket club somewhere, you suddenly realize you could deploy your own satellites. Then when you suddenly realize that it only costs, did you know you can do a ride share with 4 satellites from only $30,000?
Wait, really?
Yeah. Europe, baby. Europe. So
I need to go tell my wife I'm spending $30,000.
There's loads of cheap ride share programs for the 1U and the 2U cube satellites. Now, one of the things we're going to be doing when we've done some revenue generating is we're actually moving all of our encryption into the literal cloud. We're going to be launching our own CubeSat. No, we're not using Starlink. We're going to be deploying our own system. And we are not going to be sitting in the low orbital area either. We're going for something a little more interesting. We're also designing protective satellite counteroffensive capabilities into the CubeSat as well. Because, you know, it seems like satellite defense is going to have to be a thing now. So, you know, you have to design that in. But the reality is space deployment of technology into space is it within, if you can afford to buy a car, you can afford to do a satellite launch.
Yeah, that is that's really fascinating, because that's exactly like what I'm working on my PhD for, is
you need to hit me up after this, because if you're doing a PhD and you've already got your PhD funding, we could possibly do a collab project there, because we actually wanted to launch this fairly soon. The idea would have been to convert a Kubernetes server into one self-contained device, run it with solar and then and its own battery, and then get it up there and then see if we can maintain communications between Vox Messenger and between Vox Messenger sender receiver using that satellite connection, and making sure that we have key handling running at a speed that is commensurate to what we have here on Earth. And if it is, we would be going full beans into deployment of a full bloody constellation.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, we'll definitely talk more about this then. And, you know, I absolutely want to have you back on.
I love space stuff. I mean, I literally play, like, I put Kerbal Space Program after Civilization 5 is my biggest played game. I think I've got like 600, 700 hours on Civilization 5, and then Kerbal is like 500 or 600 on that. I love that thing.
Yeah, I started to get into KSP2 recently, and yeah, I carefully have to play it because it's like, all right, this is way too addictive. I have an 11-month-old. Like, I need to be doing other things than killing these Kerbals, you know?
Oh, my God. You see, that's what my kids do. I have not killed a Kerbal yet. I literally do proper space missions, man. I do the pen and paper working out my Delta V because I can't trust the calculator. And I actually work out how my vehicle is going to operate under pressure load and stuff. Oh, my God. We play it so differently.
My space program has a very robust astronaut pipeline.
And just think, that could be the consumer capitalist model of spacefaring in the future.
Right. Awesome. Well, JB, you know, I don't want to keep you beyond. I know people have other commitments and whatnot, but, you know, I really appreciate you coming on. This was a fantastic conversation. And like, I'm immediately going to be scheduling you to come back on, like, maybe next week.
Hell yeah. I'm all over that. Hell yeah. I'll be
awesome.
Here.
Well, you know, before I let you go, how about you tell my audience, you know, where they can find you, where they can find your company that we didn't even talk about, you know, and all that information that they may want to learn more about.
Okay. Well, if you want to join the secure revolution, to get Vox Messenger, all you got to do is type in Vox Messenger into the Android Play Store or into Google and you'll find it. It's just there. The website is vox-messenger.app. You can find our crypto app at also the Google Play Store just by typing in Vox Crypto. We are coming to iOS on both very soon, but iOS is a very different animal and it does take a lot of pain, hardship, and a lot of money to get there. Jin Technologies, my spatial recording. If you want to have the Adobe Premiere of end-to-end spatial video recording so you can make your own 3D films and then make money getting them onto Apple for the Apple Vision Pro, then check out spatialscan3d.com. You know, or just type in JBWB2020 into Twitter and you'll find me. I'm always there. I'm also always streaming in the background while I'm working. Maybe I'll be streaming some music. You can always jump in and message me. I will try to answer. And I'm on LinkedIn. Again, my name is very unique. JB Webb Benjamin or John Brunel Webb Benjamin. Trust me, you'll find it. It's only me that comes up in a Google search. I mean, I did say at the beginning of this, my parents must have hated me for giving me a name like that in Birmingham in the 1980s. But it does mean that my SEO is on point. So you can find me just by typing in my name. And my telephone number is out there. So if you find it, text me or reach out to me on Vox Messenger. You may not get a reply straight away, but you will. I'm a firm believer in being accountable and transparent.
Awesome. Well, thanks, JB, for coming on, and thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I'll definitely be having JB back on.